This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Nice to have you along this morning. Over a six-month period, WUWM and Lake Effect have been looking at the high rate of black male incarceration in the Milwaukee area and the impact it has on the community. We've taken a look at the current data showing that Wisconsin jails more of its black men than any other state in the country. But today, we're going to examine some older data. In fact, some of the first data ever collected about African Americans and crime. Writer Khalil Gibran Muhammad argues that that earliest of data shapes how society views blacks even today. Muhammad is the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library and author of the book The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. And he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Mitch, for having me. This is a real treat.
There were presumably not a lot of statistics and social science surrounding blacks prior to emancipation. So at what point did statistics even start being collected, and to what end were they aimed?
Oh, that's a great question. The earliest statistics to really document and say something meaningful about black people occurred as early as the 1870 census, which was the first census after 4 million formerly enslaved people could be recorded in a significant and meaningful way. Earlier census covered enslaved people, but they weren't used to comment on the health and welfare of this population. So it's really only at the moment, at the end of slavery, that census data becomes the basis for measuring the health and welfare of black people. And so much of what precedes the end of slavery is predicated on who black people really are. Are they actually capable of a term then used, statecraft? Can they help to lead the nation? Can they be productive citizens as free people? So it's not until the 1890 census, the first census to record black people, that is considered authoritative. And it's also a generational moment because this census records the first African Americans who had not been born into slavery. And that said something meaningful because you could actually see how are black people doing without having been touched by, for people who had defended slavery, the beneficent hand of slavery itself.
They hadn't been technically touched by slavery itself, but that is not to say that slavery didn't shape who these people were.
Well, this is a demographic point. So if you're born in 1865, you've not been enslaved, literally. So someone like W.E.B. Du Bois, the first black Harvard-trained PhD, is born in 1868. So slavery has nothing to do essentially with his childhood. I mean, of course, the legacies of slavery is a slightly different way of putting it. And the circulation of ideas about black people as inferior, the early evidence of legalized segregation that comes to be known as Jim Crow are apparent. But just as a matter of a demographic claim, how many black babies are born? What do they die of? What kinds of diseases do black people get? All of those sort of indices of social welfare are predicated on this notion that a whole generation of black people were born into freedom.
Would you say that the initial work that purported to link black people with an innate criminality, if you will, was it explicitly rooted in racism, or would we just think of it as poor data analysis today?
Oh, it was explicitly rooted in racism. Actually, it turns out that one might think, looking back on this period, that the criminalization of African Americans was always there and a deliberate project, when in fact, the enslaved population, part of slavery was predicated on this notion that black people were a child race, that they were not sophisticated enough to actually commit some of the high crimes of the white race. And that means that the invention of the criminality of the race ties to statistics is worked out after slavery because there's a need to justify discrimination. There's a need to keep black people in a particular location in society. There's a need to expand the criminal justice system to simply coerce the actual practice and meaning of freedom in America.
Well, and one of the interesting things that you chronicle is that as this started to play out, researchers treated black and white criminality differently, that for blacks, criminality was evidence of an innate inferiority, if you will. But whites were treated, and I think the term was, as the great unfortunates.
That's right, the great army of unfortunates. So one of the terrific moments that occurs in the late 19th century is the confluence of the emergence of social science and sociology in particular and the Second Industrial Revolution. So this is a moment where the capacity of America to employ unskilled workers far exceeds the number of unskilled workers, which opens the floodgates of immigration, bringing 1 million European immigrants, usually Southern and Eastern European origin, to the United States. But that also produces a bit of a social crisis in these big cities. So there's the work is not stable. There aren't living wages. There's no collective bargaining that we come to know in the context of the post-New Deal period, which means there's a lot of crime and violence in communities where people are marginal and trying to make the best of a difficult situation. So the progressives who become the voice of reform, of urban reform in this moment, begin to see the evidence of criminality amongst working class whites and European immigrants as symptomatic of class inequality in America, as symptomatic of nativism and xenophobia, where everyone doesn't get an equal chance to participate. It's in that precise moment that the language and discourse of black people as criminals is serving a kind of white supremacist narrative that legitimizes Jim Crow, but black people live in those cities too. And so in the same space in Chicago, Detroit, New York, Philadelphia, black people's criminality is fueling a discourse of pathology, of racializing African Americans as different and deficient, while at the same time the evidence of high rates of criminality and poverty among whites is fueling a class narrative that ultimately is about transforming society.
This is the issue that whites were more easily assimilable into mainstream white culture, but there was something that was keeping blacks from ever being able to assimilate in the same way.
Well, yes, that's how it was articulated, but we don't want to put the cart before the horse. So the discourse of an army of unfortunates set aside the language of black people are their own worst enemies actually makes possible the mythology that European immigrants are more assimilable. This is the actual making of a white supremacist notion that Americanization and assimilation is about white people, a form of white privilege institutionalized that we know today. This is when it's being worked out, when it's actually being invented in a contemporary industrial moment. So ultimately, they gave resources to teach English, to provide quality, though debatable, compulsory education for European immigrants, provided a network of social service agencies and a social infrastructure, while at the same time redlining black people out of those resources. So then to then come and say that these groups are more assimilable, well, that is actually putting a circular argument based on the choices, the policy choices that had already been made.
They're more assimilable because we're giving them more opportunity to assimilate.
Correct.
One of the key figures who emerges in your recounting of this period is a man named Frederick Hoffman. Who was he, and why did his analysis in particular play such a large role in how society was viewing the place of African Americans in the broader context?
Well, he's like the Alexis de Tocqueville of this moment. He's a German immigrant to the United States in 1884. Unlike de Tocqueville, he doesn't have the credentials and is not essentially a well-known foreign observer, but he creates a space for himself to see things in the demographics of the industrial moment with regard to race that others just had not noticed. He's one of the first people to document high rates of suicide in our nation's cities, something that had not been the focus of national discussion. And he also essentially stumbles upon the census data that shows that African Americans in 1890 were 30% of the nation's prisoners, but only 12% of the population. Now, on the face of it, it's not clear what we would make of that. We could see it as symptomatic of convict leasing and chain gangs and the criminalization of Southern blacks in the South, or we could see it as evidence of a kind of problem of freedom that black people don't quite know the rules of the road. Either way, Hoffman creates the blueprint for the interpretation of what that number meant. And his interpretation was that this is unimpeachable evidence that black people actually are predisposed to crime if left to their own devices. And that's significant not just because he innovated the framework for that. It's significant because he did it in a colorblind way. He did it from the perspective of being a paid actuarial for Prudential Life Insurance located in Newark, New Jersey. He did it from the perspective of being an outsider to race relations as a person who was of European origin, who was an immigrant, who had no blood on his hands from the Civil War. He also did it from the perspective of the North, which is a big deal. He says, listen, people in the North fought for black freedom. And if it turns out there are higher rates of criminality in a place like Newark or Chicago in the early 20th century, then it must be something wrong with black people and not whites.
But he jumps to this conclusion without necessarily any academic credentials to back it up.
Well, this is a period where most people don't have these kinds of academic credentials. He's writing this in 1896. Sociology is not really even founded. So the nation's leading sociology department for urban analysis becomes the Chicago School of Sociology, and it's not yet even known as the Chicago School of Sociology. It opens in 1892. So he's able to innovate in a moment where his perspective becomes the baseline for other scholars to look at. I'll give you one very quick example. The very first textbook on American criminology is written by a scholar named Charles R. Henderson. In the first edition of his book, he doesn't cite Frederick Hoffman. In the second edition of his book, which comes out after Hoffman's book, he cites Hoffman as the foremost authority on the question of black criminality. That's how significant Hoffman was. Hoffman also lives a long time. He becomes what is known as the dean of American homicide statistics. Think about this. Here's a man who comes to national attention with a prescription about black people that is all doom and gloom, that they're not capable of incorporation because of their crime problem. And yet he is the leading authority on American homicide statistics before the federal government records and collects such data, which doesn't happen until the 1930s. So he's an incredibly significant figure.
What kind of research was being done to counter what Frederick Hoffman's conclusions were at that time? How many researchers were taking a contrarian eye towards it?
Most were not. Most were swept away by the elegance of the claim. And by that I mean this statistical evidence seemed to dispel a lot of the soft racial science that had preceded it. So some of it was just, well, because black people had been enslaved, therefore they're inferior. Well, that didn't pass muster for some people. Others were biological scientists who had measured the size of black people's brains compared to those of European origin, and by their own standards, they couldn't correlate brain size with intelligence. So Hoffman comes on the fore with this very elegant argument. By virtue of the behavior of black people, not their biology per se, not their physical traits, we see that when they're not touched by white people, they revert to what he called an ancestral condition. Only African Americans, by and large, began to challenge this received wisdom.
Well, and so somewhat later, uniform crime reporting statistics first came along, and they were supposed to be strictly evidence-based, if you will. How did the UCR data change how society looked at this issue?
Everyone looks to UCR data to see how each municipality is doing. So it's a big deal. When it comes on the scene in 1930, there's an internal debate that grows out of 3 decades of struggle by black sociologists and criminologists to question what crime statistics can actually tell us about black people as a race. And so in that moment, you have 2 incredibly influential criminologists, Edwin Sutherland and Thorsten Sahlin, who have been charged by the federal government to help develop the uniform crime reports. In the earliest days, they wanted to give caution to what they knew would be the practice of intuiting racial inferiority based on disproportionate evidence of arrests of African Americans. And so in the very earliest reports, they put big footnotes on the early data that said you cannot compare races based on what is in the crime tables. It's also true that in the early tables, at the local level and in the federal uniform crime reports, there was a lot more focus on European immigrant groups as distinct groups. So you could look in crime data at the arrest level and see Italians, you could see the Irish, you could see Polish, you could see Jews, you could see Germans, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what happens very quickly is that the foreign-born groups become incorporated or assimilated into the white category and essentially leaves the understanding of relative crime behavior as either white, black, Indian, Mexican, and other. Now, the Indian and Mexican categories were very small demographically. So essentially, black became the uniform category for measuring deviance against a white norm. That's meaningful because if you could tell how many Italian Americans committed armed robbery or were involved in bootlegging or other forms of illegal activity, you could disparage the group for its criminality. But if you could no longer tease out Italian Americans or Irish Americans, then all you're left with is this homogenous group of whites, which becomes the uniform norm of propriety and law-abidingness.
Well, and right. And so then the only demographic group that you can tease out to ascribe anything to is blacks.
That's correct. And just as a matter of statistical, I like this to point this out. In a homogenous country where everyone is quote unquote white, you can't have disproportionate anything. Because if the norm is 100% white, then there can't be an overrepresentation of whites in prison. There can't be an overrepresentation of whites in the arrest statistics. But with a population as small as African Americans, only 12% today, but in some of these cities, these northern cities at the time, it was 5, 6, 7%, you can have huge statistical disproportions because it's a very small population.
How influential do you think this body of work that started a century ago is today in how society views African Americans in crime?
Well, I would say that all of the thinking, the language, the ideas that circle around these conversations about black people and criminality, all of that is tied to this earlier moment. Just like the wiring in this building owes a debt to the inventions of Thomas Edison and Louis Latimer, so too are these ideas still very much a part of the infrastructure of the late 19th century. This is one part of U.S. history, not the issue of racism in the criminal justice system as a general category, but to the point of the statistical narratives about black people as criminal or pathological that we've just simply not dealt with. And so we're no more evolved today on this topic than we were back then.
Even if we as a society don't necessarily think of it in terms of inferiority, something racially inferior about African Americans leading to crime, it's all rooted in this original notion.
Well, let me be even clearer. Most people today articulate notions of black people's criminality based on what? Based on statistics. And so the disproportionate evidence of black people committing crimes, whether it's inner city violence, whether it's drugs, or even in-school suspensions, the facts are tied to the statistics, which is to say we're no different than Frederick Hoffman in saying because of the statistical evidence that we see of disproportionate offending, black people have a crime problem. Evidence of disproportionate criminality does not have to equal pathologization, does not have to equal inferiority. So therefore, we are stuck with Hoffman's formulation rather than the intervention that progressives made that said, actually, high rates of criminality are telling us something about economic insecurity and inequality when we have white populations. But a black population, which is 10% of the population, which was always a source of some form of white supremacist backlash or at least racial ambivalence, well, maybe we can lock up the entire black population and hence makes possible in a deindustrialized world where we don't need black labor the possibilities for mass incarceration, which is what we have today.
Do you think those years of this attitude that it inherently criminalized blacks, have they been internalized at all by the black community itself?
Absolutely. And I think many people would agree. But that actually works against the argument of an economic insecurity problem or the need for robust socialization. In fact, since the days of W.E.B. Du Bois has been an argument of internalized racism. And in fact, the internalized racism argument, though it comes from the perspective of people who have a structural critique, say that people have accepted the white supremacist arguments of black pathology and now have turned on themselves and their community, that becomes an excuse for what? A cultural renaissance. It becomes an excuse for saying, well, we've got to change the thinking of people. But that's not going to change the economic insecurity that was the primary focus of the attention of the policymakers and the social reformers of the early period that transformed the lives of working class whites and European immigrants. And so until we put that back on the table in a sustained and enduring way, we're going to be left basically telling black people that, well, we know that racism has something to do with this problem, but ultimately it's your problem to fix.
Well, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad's book is called The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America, published by Harvard University Press. Muhammad is director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. He was in Milwaukee this week to speak at Marquette University as one of the school's Ralph Metcalf chairs this semester. A quick break now, and then a new report looks with some alarm at the quality of after-school programs in Milwaukee County. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.